And as has been pointed out, others, there could have been multiple versions of that in multiple different districts across the country. So what's different about that? How do we avoid the conclusion there that the president wasn't subject to some special immunity, but here is?
I think the nature of the case that we're dealing with here is not in a vacuum itself. There are other cases that the president is dealing with at the same time. So what may have been a situation for President Clinton with a lawsuit, we have multiple litigation going on, including with the New York Attorney General. So I think the Supremacy Clause issue and the Article II issue here is pronounced, as this court alluded to, in Clinton against Jones for that very reason, this idea that local prejudice would impact the president. So the idea that we would wait until there's more of these, we're already here on three cases involving multiple subpoenas, much of which covers the same documentation. So I think it in fact, Justice Gorsuch, proves the point. We're here because the House has asked for documents that now the district attorney is asking for. So we are seeing that in real time, the burdensome nature of what's happening here.
How is this more burdensome, though, than what took place in Clinton versus Jones? I guess I'm not sure.
There's a big distinction between a defendant in a civil case and a principal in a criminal case here by the state district of local DA.
Let me stop you there. Yes, they sought the deposition of the president while he was serving. Here, they are seeking records from third parties.
But they're his records from third parties, Justice Gorsuch. The third party is simply the agent custodian of the president's tax returns on the president's statement of financial conditions. So these are the president's documents that they're asking. And what's to stop them from seeking a deposition of the president, or, for that matter, asking the president to appear before a grand jury? Because if the official versus unofficial was the deciding factor, and our view is that the initiation of process here interferes with the president's official duty, but if there was going to be this unofficial official distinction put in place, well, then what stops the local district attorney from having the president testify, having the president tried?
This is Justice Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and good afternoon, Mr. Sekulow.
Good afternoon.
Just following up on Justice Gorsuch, just explain, if you can, the rationale for having one rule for criminal and another rule for civil. Just assume there's one criminal investigation, that's it.
Well,
and just explain the rationale for a different rule there.
Well, it's not that it's a different rule, because in this case, because it's within the context of a state proceeding, you have Article II concerns, and it's the Supremacy Clause issues, as this court alluded to in Clinton against Jones, that create the issues of concern about local prejudice. But the criminal nature of it creates a burden very distinct from a civil case, to be clear. Someone that is targeted.
Why is that?
Well, the idea that you are the subject or a target of a criminal case being brought against you is very different than a civil suit, where at the end of the day, it results in monetary damages, not a loss of liberty. So there's a big distinction between a civil case and a criminal case in that regard. And I think that impacts the standard upon which this court should be looking at the president's temporary presidential immunity. We're talking about stopping a process targeting the president, this subpoena targeting the president. That's what we're talking about here. It is that burden that is our concern.
I think the other side says that the position you're articulating is a bit more consistent with Justice Breyer's concurrence in Clinton versus Jones than with the majority opinion. In his concurrence, he said that judges hearing a private civil damages action against a sitting president may not issue orders that could significantly distract a president from his official duties. And it's pointed out that that language was not in the majority opinion. What do you think about how we should assess that?
Civil discovery versus criminal processes are two very distinct processes. And in a civil context, in a civil proceeding, we have the federal rules of civil procedure in a federal court that govern how that process goes forward, and federal judges can take into various considerations, especially dealing with the president. This is a state proceeding. Initiated by the local district attorney against the sitting president of the United States. So our concern here is this: the nature of the proceeding itself is why we view categorically that a subpoena targeting the president and his records here would
be
violated.
How do you deal with statute of limitations issues?
Well, the statute of limitation issues, of course, are decided under New York state law. And under New York state law, there would be procedures that could be utilized if, in fact, the DEA were to elect to start a process like that, or if there were to eventually be action. But I need to say something.
Thank you.
Yep,
thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mute on.
General Francisco?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. At a minimum, a local prosecutor should have to show he really needs the president's personal records to subpoena them for two reasons. First, as the court suggested in Clinton against Jones, state proceedings can pose a greater threat to the presidency. The 2,300 prosecutors across the country necessarily place more emphasis on local interests than national ones. A special needs standard ensures that federal courts balance the prosecutor's local need for information against national interests, including the president's need to do his job. Second, ordinary grand jury rules are not designed to protect Article II interests. That's why in Nixon, the court held a federal prosecutor had to show a demonstrated specific need for the information sought. A local prosecutor should at least be required to meet the same standard. As the court has repeatedly said, in no case of this kind would a court be required to proceed against the president as against an ordinary citizen. And here the district attorney hasn't tried to meet the special needs standard.
General Francisco, we just heard Mr. Sekulow argue in favor of an absolute standard. No circumstances, no how. Your position is that, as you say, at a minimum, the special needs test must be met. Of course, Mr. Sekulow is representing Mr. Trump. You're representing the United States. You're arguing for a more flexible standard. So what was wrong with Mr. Trump's position?
Your Honor, I actually think that Mr. Sekulow makes a very strong argument on the immunity issue. We just don't think it's one that the court needs to address, at least until the prosecutor argues and attempts to meet the special needs standard. Here, since the prosecutor hasn't argued and isn't arguing before this court that he meets the special needs standard, there's no reason for the court to address the broader immunity question, and it's the court's ordinary processes to try to avoid those broader and more difficult questions when possible. And here we think that the special needs standard would fully resolve this case at this stage of the proceedings.
Well, in a typical case with adequate allegations to say that the standard's implicated, you would say that it goes before a court and the court will examine whether or not the criteria you talk about, which I gather is the test under Nixon, are met. And under Mr. Sekulow's standard, would not immediately go before the court. He was looking for a ruling from us saying that he's absolutely immune, so the court would have no business addressing such a case. That's a very significant difference.
Well, Your Honor, I think that in both instances, the argument would be available to an article. You'd be able to make that argument to an Article II federal court. Under our argument, if the court found that the prosecutor hadn't met the Nixon special needs standard, it wouldn't need to address the broader immunity question. If it did find that the district attorney met the special needs standard, it would have to then address the broader immunity question. And all we are saying is that unless and until the special need issue is addressed at the threshold, there's no need to address the broader immunity question in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Thomas?
Yes. General Francisco, you mentioned the level of threat to the president or burden on the president. How do we determine that when it's too much?
Well, Your Honor, here I think there are a couple of things that you can take into account. First, the fact that we're in state court I think is quite significant. Local prosecutors are necessarily going to put more emphasis on local interests than national ones. It simply reflects the manner in which they rise to office through elections by local, relatively homogenous political communities. And in New York State, I would also add that the trial court judges are elected in a similar way. So there you've already got this risk of local prejudice. And so what the special needs standard does it ensures that there's a federal court that's available to balance the local interests against the national ones, including the president's need to do his job. And then secondly, it also has to do with the ordinary grand jury rules that would apply to a local prosecutor exercising his authority. Those rules were not designed to, and they're not sufficient to protect Article II interests. Since under ordinary grand jury rules, a district attorney never has to make a particularized showing of need. Instead, the burden is on the witness to show that the subpoena can have no conceivable relevance to any plausible subject of an investigation. Now, that is a perfectly appropriate standard in the ordinary case, but the reason why Nixon applied the special needs standard above and beyond the ordinary rules of criminal procedure was because the court recognized that the president is the sole person in whom all Article II powers are vested. And so he is entitled to a measure of protection above and beyond the ordinary rules. And the special needs standard is one of those measures of protection. To put point back to Justice Breyer's a very persuasive concurrence in Clinton against Jones, I think Justice Breyer correctly predicted that this court would need to develop special protective procedures precisely for the president in the context of litigation like this.
Justice Ginsburg?
You stress that the states are subordinate sovereigns they are subject to the Supremacy Clause, but you don't give any credit at all to the 10th Amendment and the reserve powers of the state. That's one question that I have. And as far as the impact of the president is concerned, I think there's no case more dramatic than the Nixon tapes. Devastating impact on the president. He resigned from office. But yet, that was okay. So I really don't get it.
Your Honor, in terms of the 10th Amendment, all we're saying is that Article II vests all executive power in a single president of the United States. He is the sole person in whom all executive power is vested, and so that necessarily implies that there are limits on what others can do to unduly burden him in his ability to do his job. So all that the special needs standard does is ensure that a prosecutor really needs the president's information before he can enforce that subpoena. Since if he can't even show that he really needs the information, he's necessarily imposing an undue burden on the president and creating a serious risk of harassment. And if you multiply that by 2,300 prosecutors across the country, I think that the risk to the presidency is quite obvious. In terms of the Nixon case, we are actually arguing for the same standard that the court applied in the Nixon case, the special needs standard. We're just saying that a local prosecutor in state court should be, at a minimum, be required to meet the same standard that the federal prosecutor in Nixon had to meet and show that he really does need the information that he's seeking. Since, again, if he doesn't, it's unnecessarily burdensome.
Yes, Your Honor. The grand jury is an investigatory body. It doesn't make, at the outset, specific charging decisions while the investigation is underway. It investigates in order to determine should there be specific charging decisions. But you would have them make charging decision before they investigate, and that seems to be backward.
Your Honor, respectfully, no. I would simply urge that you apply the same standard that Judge Wald applied in the Henry Fields case, which was a grand jury subpoena issued to the White House, where she concluded properly, in our view, that Nixon's special needs standard ought to apply to grand jury subpoenas. It's not, you don't have to make a charging decision, but you do have to show a demonstrated, specific, particularized need for the information pursuant to which you are issuing the grand jury subpoena.
Justice Breyer?
Thank you. General, I think that Nixon tape case has one thing for you, one thing against you. The thing against you, I think it was a case where executive privilege was asserted. But what's for you, and I think might be more relevant, is in that case, the court said, well, there has been first a weighing of the burdensome nature, et cetera, a lot of other things in that, in the lower courts that have decided that it is appropriate to go forward. Now, what I don't see is why you need a special standard more than that here, the ordinary standard. You would need a decision by us that it's reviewable in federal court. I understand that. But I don't see why you have to go beyond that, where the things you're talking about would be taken into account.
Your Honor, you are absolutely correct that at a minimum we would need federal court review. And in that regard, I would note that the district attorney here agrees that there are Article II limits on what he can do, and that those Article II limits are in federal court. But respectfully, I would suggest that Nixon stands for more than simply some kind of weighing of interests. Nixon applied the special needs standard, and it said that the prosecutor did, in fact, have to show a particularized need for the information. That's all that we're suggesting ought to apply.
Yeah, but wasn't that in the context of an assertion of executive privilege?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Wasn't that in the context of an assertion by the president of executive privilege?
Yes, Your Honor, it was, but litigation about private conduct is also burdensome, and as the court recognized in Clinton against Jones, the president might well need more protection in state court than he gets in federal court precisely because of the risk of local prejudice, and that's why the court reserved judgment on that question. So I think when you put those two things together, it does make it entirely appropriate to hold a local prosecutor in state court to the same standard as the federal prosecutor was held to in the Nixon case. And indeed, even if you were to take the district attorney's own case-specific test, I think you would need the special needs standard. After all, we don't typically get discovery into a grand jury proceeding. So the only way to assess at the front end whether the prosecutor is issuing an unduly burdensome subpoena or issuing a subpoena in bad faith is to require some kind of showing of special need. After all, why would a local...
Justice Alito? General, could you explain in more specific terms how you think this showing of special need would be carried out in district court? I assume that the prosecutor would have to make some kind of, would have to reveal what was being investigated and why this particular information was needed for or essential for the investigation. Now, would that be done, would that be reviewed by the judge ex parte? Would it be available to whoever the sitting president is to object to that, to review it and object to it?
Your Honor, it's difficult to answer that question in a vacuum because I think it would very much depend on the particular case, but let me make my best stab at it. I think that in order to have meaningful judicial review, you would need the prosecutor would need to make public as much as could responsibly be made public so that the president would have an opportunity and the president's lawyers would have an opportunity to make their case on the particular facts. If there is a certain amount of evidence that really cannot responsibly be made public, then I think it would be appropriate to consider ex parte proceedings or filings under seal. In all events, we think that that's the type of assessment that needs to be made when you're talking about subpoenas, unprecedented subpoenas like this one, that are from state and local prosecutors targeting the President of the United States. The other place I would point you to is, again, Judge Wald's very good opinion for the D.C. Circuit in the In Re Field case, where she does walk through in some amount of detail and unpack how the special needs standard applies to grand jury subpoenas.
How essential must the information be in order to meet this special needs standard? Does it have to be absolutely indispensable, not available from any other source by any conceivable means, or simply very useful?
Your Honor, it's probably somewhere in between those two things. I think it's got to be critical to the charging decision, so it can't just be marginally useful or, you know, merely duplicative or interesting to a tangential side issue. It does have to be critical to the charging decision. if the information is readily available elsewhere. I don't see how a prosecutor could meet the special needs standard. And if the information he currently does have is sufficient for him to make a responsible charging decision, I also don't think he could meet the special needs standard. So I guess I would put
counsel,
it somewhere.
Justice Sotomayor?
General, there's always danger in taking a doctrine adopted for one set of needs, and that has to do with needs that are balancing what is clearly recognized in law as executive privilege versus the needs for the proceeding at issue, and transplanting it to a situation that's totally different, where we're not talking about a claim of executive privilege, and we're not talking of executive immunity. We're talking about private activities that predated the president's tenure. So why are we using all that transplanted language, and why don't we get to a standard that takes care of what you're worried about, which is harassment and interference, and simply ask whether the investigation is based on credible suspicion of criminal activity, and whether the subpoena is reasonably calculated to advance that investigation. A standard that looks to whether there is a good faith basis for the state prosecutor's actions, and whether the subpoena is reasonable in its scope and burdens. I don't understand why that sort of standard is inadequate, especially for a proceeding that involves secrecy, like a grand jury subpoena.
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, for the reasons that I think Justice Breyer did persuasively explain in Clinton against Jones, even litigation about private conduct can be quite burdensome, and that is particularly so when you're talking about private conduct that's being litigated in state court pursuant to state procedures. So I think that's why he correctly predicted that this court would need in future cases to develop special protective procedures precisely in this context. And secondly, I think that the special protective procedure that we are proposing here is necessary even under Your Honor's general approach. After all, why would a prosecutor take the unprecedented step of issuing a subpoena to the President of the United States for personal records from a local prosecutor if he can't even show that he really needs the information that he's seeking? If he can't make that showing, I think there is a pretty good reason to be a little bit suspicious. After all, very few prosecutors...
Justice Kagan?
So, General, a couple of times now, in response to Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor, you've explained why we should use the standard from executive privilege cases by saying, well, litigation about private conduct is also burdensome. But the point about executive privilege cases is not that it's burdensome. I mean, the critical factor is the weighty interest that a president has in communicating with advisors on official matters, often about national security, often about military matters, and the need for confidentiality in that. And that's why the Nixon standard was developed, not because of generalized ideas about burdensomeness, which can be dealt with in other ways. So again, why should that standard be used here?
Respectfully, Yarn, because I think that they're parallel interests. Executive privilege, you are right, is meant to protect the confidentiality of communications, but Article 2 more generally is meant to protect the president from being unduly burdened in his ability to carry out his responsibilities. And I think that's particularly necessary when you're talking about state court proceedings by the many, many 2,300 local prosecutors across the country who, again, are more responsive to local political constituencies and local interests the national one. So I think
again,
that when you
General,
look at articles...
You don't need this heightened standard in order to take account of burdensomeness. Burdensomeness is something that can be addressed in any subpoena, and I'm sure that courts, when it gets to the president and the special responsibilities of the president, will address those interests with respect, with sensitivity, especially if we tell them so. So why would you need this heightened standard that is meant to protect confidential communications about official government business?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, because under the ordinary grand jury rules, the only question as to burdensomeness is whether the subpoena has any conceivable relevance to any plausible subject of investigation and therefore is unduly burdensome. And secondly, I think that judgment has to be made by federal courts, not state courts, because state courts, like local prosecutors, are going to be more responsive to local interests. After all, in New York State, trial court judges, like the district attorneys, are elected in partisan elections. So all we're saying is that this is the type of assessment that needs to be made in federal court, and the most appropriate and easy to apply standard is the standard that you've already been applying for 50 years under the Nixon case. And we
Thank
think
you,
that
counsel.
That is
Justice Gorsuch?
Counsel, I'd like to just explore a little further how this standard would that you're proposing would play out in practice. I suppose you'd have a local prosecutor saying, I'm investigating a tax infraction. And the best and maybe only evidence of that potential infraction are the tax records in the possession of the potential defendant. Why wouldn't that meet the special heightened test that you proposed in every case? And if it does, then what have we achieved?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would depend on who the potential defendant is. If the potential defendant is the President of the United States, here the district attorney doesn't contest the fact that he cannot indict the President of the United States until after he leaves office. So he wouldn't be able to show that he needs the information now in order to indict the President of the United States. Of course, if the potential defendant is somebody else, then it might start looking closer to the Nixon case itself, where the special counsel was investigating a third party. And I think that would, in fact, be a relevant consideration under the special needs standard.
I guess I didn't follow that last portion of it. Let's say the infraction is by a corporation or some entity. And we need the prosecutor is going to say we need these materials in order to determine whether there is an infraction.
Right.
Why wouldn't that qualify under your standard?
I think that would certainly be a relevant thing to take into account under our standard. And if he actually met the special need test with respect to the information and found that it was really necessary in order to bring charges against that third party, he may well meet the special need standard, and then you'd have to address the broader immunity questions. In this particular...
How much showing of a special need is required under your standard? The prosecutor says, I have some reasonable suspicion that there's a tax deficiency by some entity. Is that enough?
Your Honor, I think it's more than that. I think he's got to show that the information he's seeking is critical to him responsibly making a charging decision, that he can't get that information from somewhere else, and the information that he does have is insufficient. It's essentially the same standard the court applied. This court applied in Nixon. The D.C. Circuit applied in the Henry Field case. You know, it's not like it's a hard and fast bright line rule, but it is an administrable rule that courts have been applying for some 50 years now.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and good afternoon, General Francisco. I want to follow up on Justice Thomas and Justice Kagan and really zero in on what the Article II interest is before we talk about what standard. And I think in Justice Breyer's concurrence in Clinton against Jones, he referred to the interest in time and energy distraction, which he drew from Nixon versus Fitzgerald, a different Nixon case, as an independent Article II interest that is distinct from distortion of official decision making, which would be more the executive privilege kind of interest. Is that the Article II interest you're zeroing in on, or is it something else?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think it's both of them, and as I read Justice Breyer's opinion, he likewise understood it to be both of them. The whole idea is that Article II vests all executive power in a single person. And that necessarily means that others can't unnecessarily hobble or debilitate that person in his ability to responsibly carry out his duties. So the whole point of the special needs standard is to ensure that others, including prosecutors, can't unnecessarily impede the president in carrying out his responsibilities. So at a minimum, they have to show that they really need the information that they're seeking. Since if you have 2,300 prosecutors that are unnecessarily hitting the president with subpoenas and none of them can actually show they really need that information, you're necessarily going to be undermining the president's ability to effectively carry out the Article II duties that the Constitution entrusts to him and to him alone on behalf of the entire country.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Dunn?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. There are two principles at issue in this case. One is the central role of the president in the functioning of our national government and the need to avoid interfering with the president's ability to carry out those important duties. The other principle is that under our Constitution, when a president acts as a private individual, he or she has responsibilities like every other citizen, including compliance with legal process. In particular, this court has long held that American presidents are not above having to provide evidence in response to a law enforcement inquiry. We're mindful that as a state actor, our office cannot investigate a president for any official acts, and that we cannot prosecute a president while in office. But here, we're talking about a subpoena sent to a third party concerning private conduct by a variety of individuals and businesses. Yes, one of them is the president, but no one's been targeted or charged with anything. There's no claim of any official acts or any executive privilege. As the courts below found, the subpoena imposes no Article II burden whatsoever and was not born of any political animus or intent to harass. Instead, it was prompted by public reports that certain business transactions in our jurisdiction were possibly illegal. Given those allegations, our office would have been remiss not to follow up. In response, the president asked the court to overturn 200 years of precedent by declaring he has a blanket immunity while in office from any legal inquiry, even for his prior private acts, even though that could result in a permanent immunity for him and the other parties if the statutes of limitation expire, and even though it could prevent the discovery of evidence that could exonerate the individuals involved. Finally, his novel claim also asked the court to presume that state actors have a, quote, reckless mania that will cause them to, quote, relentlessly harass presidents, and that state and federal courts will allow prosecutors to do so. Of course, there's no historical support for this claim, which flies in the face of federalism. The supposed floodgates have been open for generations, and there's never been a flood. The only thing new here is the subpoena comes from a state, but absent a constitutional burden, that shouldn't lead the court to abandon its longstanding respect for state criminal proceedings.
Thank you, counsel. You know, we've had the cases this morning and this case, and they are in many respects very similar. In the case of the subpoena itself, they're identical. But I think in other respects, they're really quite different. The separation of powers case this morning involved entities in an ongoing relationship, the House and the President, and issues of this sort, although always very important, come up with some regularity. There's often disputes between the White House and Congress over documents, and almost always they're worked out because each of those branches have authorities and powers that affect each other. You know, if the Senate asks for documents from the White House and the White House doesn't give them, then the Senate says, well, we're going to, you know, take our time confirming your nominees and back and forth. But with respect to local prosecutors, you don't have that ongoing relationship. So the possibility of working something out is far less evident. And if you're doing that, the stakes are, well, it's just a little more difficult because there isn't that ongoing relationship. So shouldn't there be a higher standard before we permit the district attorneys from around the country, but there are also more of them than the two houses of Congress, 2,300 of them. Shouldn't there be a higher standard than in the case of the separation of powers dispute?
Your Honor, I think our answer to that is yes. And putting aside its relationship or not to the separation of powers analysis, I'd like to address the DOJ's proposed heightened showing standard because we see that, let me put it this way, we see there are three reasons, I think, why the DOJ's new heightened showing proposal doesn't work. And a number of questions in the last argument, I think, touched on some of these concepts, if I might. First, One problem is that the approach that they're suggesting really reverses the court's prior approach to fact-finding in these types of cases in a way that I think would harm the grand jury process, which I can explain. So, again, we agree there should be a heightened showing requirement, but my point is only after a president has already established an actual Article II burden. Otherwise, there's nothing for a court to weigh in the balancing of Article II interests against the need for legal process, which, and that balancing and that sequencing, frankly, was both central in both Nixon and Clinton cases. Here,
could you articulate for me precisely what standard you think should apply in your case, and in what sense is it more rigorous than that would apply in the dispute between the White House and Congress?
Yes, I think we believe that a prosecutor, if there's been an affirmative showing by a president of an Article II burden, and of course the courts have below held that there has not been such a showing here, but if in a different case there was such a showing made, we believe a prosecutor should be required to show, one, an objective basis for the investigation, and two, a reasonable probability the request would yield relevant information. We think language like that would be more consistent with past cases of this court and with the realities of a grand jury investigation. And frankly, the courts below also already found that we've met that standard here. The problem is that the alternative of requiring a state prosecutor to get permission first from a federal judge for any request relating to a president's business activities would undermine this court's prior rulings, like the one in R Enterprises, that a grand jury shouldn't be burdened by procedural challenges and delays because it's a confidential process and not an adversarial proceeding. And the DOJ's new standard just ignores that. The other problem...
Justice Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Dunn, you were about to say how DOJ's approach would harm the grand jury process. Would you finish that?
Yes, and I think I was just addressing that, Justice Thomas. That is... You know, if to require us in any given case to run to across the street to federal court and say, by the way, we have an investigation underway. It happens to touch on a president's prior business transactions in which he and others were involved in. And we'd like to get permission to send a subpoena for records that are in either the possession of a president or maybe the president's agents, like his accounting firm here. Again, it completely upends the way that a grand jury process is supposed to work. If I might, the second big problem, I think, with the DOJ's analysis is that the language that they've chosen just doesn't work, contrary to wise to what I just set out, because it only applies in the context of a trial subpoena. It calls for a, quote, stringent showing that the request is, quote, directly relevant to central issues at trial and charging decisions. Again, that language just doesn't apply in the context of a grand jury when no charging decisions have been made. So that's why the formulation that we've suggested, I think, would be more consistent with what's needed in a grand jury context. But again, we think that it's utterly unnecessary here to apply in our case because, A, there's already been a finding of no Article II burden, and B, we have already met the standard by the district court's finding that our investigation is well-founded and brought in good faith. So
what limits a grand jury process in New York? What are the limits?
Well, the limits are, I think, the same basically as they are in federal court and most other states, Your Honor. I mean, yes, the recipient of a subpoena who has a basis to argue either a privilege or a burden of some sort has the right, as the president did here, to go into court and make those factual arguments that it's that either it should be quashed or constrained in some fashion. There's a grand jury judge who supervises all grand juries and their activities who's always available here. But I think the more important point, perhaps, Your Honor, is that obviously given the decision of the Court of Appeals below in this case, and to address that concern and that footnote in Clinton, at this point, it's clear that a president in particular who has a concern about this kind of impact on Article II duties now always has the ability to go into federal court and not into state court, which was the main concern in that footnote in Clinton.
What if you thought it was the president said it was impossible for him to do his job as opposed to just being burdened? Would we have a role to limit or somehow end the grand jury process?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, I think that's That's the point of the case-specific analysis, is that it gives a court, and here a federal court, to hear a concern like that expressed. And if the concern is, you know, somehow this shuts my office down, or it's a real burden, it's not just a speculative mental distraction claim, then yes, the courts are empowered to impose a wide variety of limitations, including, if necessary, to shut an investigation down or to shut a subpoena or a litigation down. That's the beauty of this court's prior decisions in Nixon and Clinton and others, which have decided consistently to apply the case-specific analysis and have rejected the notion that this is best treated with a categorical prophylactic rule. I just think that that's not appropriate here when it's also case-specific.
Thank you.
Justice Ginsburg?
The principal objections that have been raised is that when you're dealing with federal prosecutions, it's all controlled by the Attorney General. But here you have 2,300 district attorneys, each armed with grand jury subpoena power. So the control that exists in federal courts with the Attorney General at the helm and no one controlling all of these state district attorneys.
I understand, Your Honor, and I think really what that gets centrally to is the consistent argument here about the parade of horribles, if you will. And if I could address that, I think there's several answers to that concern. First of all, there's really no empirical basis in history for this apocalyptic prediction. The same claim was made and rejected by this court in Nixon and then in Clinton. That, of course, was decades ago, and there's not been a flood of subpoenas or litigations or prosecutions of presidents by states or federal prosecutors. Second, as a practical matter, you know, this notion that there are 2,300 prosecutors out there writing with their subpoena pads open, there's just no basis to think that an army of local prosecutors like that would even have jurisdiction over a president, especially for private conduct in the first place. Here, New York City, of course, has a particular connection to the Trump Organization and its financial transactions because it's headquartered here. It's not likely that more than one or many states, much less 2,300 counties, would ever have that kind of connection to a president's private conduct. Third, I think as Justice Ginsburg, you mentioned in the last argument, this view that there's a reckless mania by local prosecutors contradicts this court's longstanding presumption in favor of regularity and deference to state proceedings. And so to finish off, the limitation I think that you're asking about really comes in the form of the case-specific showing that past cases from this court have established. Because if there is a concern about the behavior of a local prosecutor, any president, when necessary, but it's been few and far between over the decades, can run now not just into state court, which Clinton thought could be problematic, but can run into federal court and raise exactly the kind of claim that the president has raised here. That's the limitation.
Thank you.
Justice Breyer.
Well, thank you. I agree with you that the two basic principles you set at the outcome are there, every man's evidence versus the constitutional statement that the president is the executive, Article 2, and they conflict. Just as in the first place, or the first case, the power of Congress, Article 1 and Article 2 conflict. All right.
I think that I would say they don't conflict, but yes, their intention.
Their intention. Fine. All right. Now, a possible solution is, say, no absolute rule, but just send it to the ordinary system for weighing the needs versus the burdens. And the different sides have to say what they are. And then have that reviewable in federal court. And because of the nature of it, and we could list in an opinion the kinds of things that might not be or might be relevant depending on the case. And eventually with the president, we might review it. All right, now all that would take time. But time itself would discourage prosecutors from doing this, which might be good. And time itself would encourage House, Congress, president to work things out in a non-judicial way. All right, I don't put that as being wedded to it. I want to know your reaction.
Well, Your Honor, I think what you're describing is exactly what this court held in Clinton, and it's exactly, frankly, what has happened now in this case, which is, yes, in this case, the president decided to pursue his claim of immunity in federal court versus state court, which is fine and now available, I think, in the future to all presidents. But I think the fact that that is, you know, what should happen in the ordinary course and which can happen in the ordinary course is, again, the solution and the limiting principle here, because it does, you know, make it clear that there is a remedy and discourages, I would have thought, bad faith impulses by any state or local prosecutor who might harbor such an impulse, and provides an outlet that makes sure that it can't get out of control. But again, that's the beauty of the case-specific analysis. I don't think these things lend themselves to categorical prophylactic rules, and that's been the approach from this court from day one.
Thank you.
Justice Alito?
As I understand your proposed standard, there would be available review in federal court, and the prosecutor would have to show an objective basis for the subpoena and the relevance of the subpoena to the investigation. Is that correct?
Basically, on our language like that, I said point two was a reasonable probability that will yield relevant information, but yes, that's the concept.
Okay, reasonable probability. What would be your objection to a somewhat more demanding standard? So the prosecutor would have to show that the information can't be obtained from another source, or it would be very difficult to obtain it from another source, and the information unless the information is obtained right now, as opposed to at the end of the president's term, there would be some serious prejudice to the investigation.
Your Honor, I frankly don't think that any of those concepts are foreign to the standard that I articulated, and I think they are relevant, in fact, to the objective basis and relevance points. You know, here, for example, and again, I think the court below, the district court in particular, you know, heard our explanations, and including the fact that, you know, the reason why we went to Mazars is not to do an end run around negotiations with the president's lawyers. It's because Mazars, as the outside accounting firm, is as far as we could tell, the only repository of what might be the most important documents in an investigation like this, which are not just the tax returns, but the surrounding accounting materials and work papers, et cetera, which shed light on the good faith or not of the transaction. So my short answer, I'm sorry, is that I think those concepts are would be fine and not unduly burdensome in the context of the standard that I set forth.
Can I ask you one other thing? Do you think that the adjudication of this in all cases of a similar nature would depend in any way on state law and practice regarding grand jury secrecy? In federal court, the rules of grand jury secrecy are, of course, very strict. States have different rules. Suppose a particular state imposes no restriction on the revelation by a member of the grand jury, or perhaps even by the prosecutor, of the information that is supplied in compliance with a subpoena.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any other states having that kind of lax or non-existent grand jury secrecy rule. I can assure the court that in New York State, our grand jury secrecy laws are at least as strict as under the federal system. But putting that aside, if in fact the fact pattern presents to a judge the prospect that the information in fact will become public, and a president were to persuade a judge that that publication of the documents at issue would themselves impose some sort of Article II burden or other interference with his executive duties in that given state, you know, I suppose that would be part of the case-specific analysis that the court could understand and take into account in deciding whether that there should be some limitation or even a quashing of the subpoena itself. I think that's part of the case-specific analysis.
I mean, we both know that prosecutors have different, that there are prosecutors who leak all sorts of information, including grand jury information, to all sorts of media sources, including in specifically the New York Times. If If there were a showing that that was a risk, would that have a bearing on this?
Your Honor, it's hard for me to I'm not aware of any kind of real pattern or practice of leaking of actual grand jury materials that are covered by grand jury secrecy. Yes, in all different kinds of offices, there are at times, you know, leaks of status of cases and that kind of thing. But I am not aware, and our grand jury secrecy rules really prevent prosecutors, I believe, from you know, actually turning over confidential grand jury secrecy materials to.
You're not aware of this ever happening. Your office is never requested by media in the New York City area to disclose confidential investigative information.
No, well, they ask all the time, Your Honor, and the answer is consistently no, at least as far as I can represent. But what I'm trying to draw a distinction between is people commenting to reporters all the time, off the record, that kind of thing, versus turning over actual materials like, you know, voluminous tax returns or other sensitive documents that have been gathered and which are covered by grand jury secrecy. That's what I just don't see happening here, and I think history supports that view.
Justice when you Sotomayor? Refer to an Article II burden, does that include the burden of harassment, the burden of using subpoenas for political purposes?
Yes, Your Honor, I would certainly include that there. And again, there's been an express finding below here that there is the investigation was well-founded, that there was no harassment or bad faith in our bringing of the subpoena.
Thank you. Justice Sotomayor?
Counsel, did I understand your answer to Justice Alito to be that you are in agreement with the SG that we should impose a heightened need standard, a special need standard?
No, Your Honor, I think we're all now calling it the heightened showing standard, or in the DOJ's lexicon now, the heightened need standard. But I think what I'm articulating is a very different standard in terms of the actual language to be looked at and imposed. Again, I think.
But wait, if you can, counsel, because I want to be very precise. If your standard includes what the heightened need standard has, then why not call it what it is, heightened need? There has to be a reason you think we shouldn't call it that. And I don't know that I understand what difference.
I'm sorry, Justice Sotomayor. The concern I have with the DOJ language is, again, calling for a stringent showing that a subpoena request is directly relevant to central issues at trial and other concepts like that. What I'm trying to propose is something I think which is not so strict and which is not limited to charging and trial-related concepts, but which would be workable in the context of a grand jury subpoena. And again, whatever the standard is that we're articulating, I want to stress that I believe that our office has met that standard here, even under the DOJ's proposal, because of the findings by the district court.
Tell me why the heightened standard would interfere with the grand jury process.
Well, I think, Your Honor, among other things, the DOJ's proposed application of its standard, if you read its brief, would confer the same absolute immunity the president is seeking here. What they say is, since you can't indict while in office, you don't need the documents while he's in office. And frankly, that's an outcome that would apply in every case. No subpoena could pass that test because they basically say, you know, you have to wait until he's out of office before gathering information because you don't need it in the meantime. And so their definition of heightened need says you don't need it while he's in office. Well, that's not workable here.
Why not?
Because, well, obviously, Your Honor, if we were to wait until a president was out of office in a situation like this, first, it would risk the loss of evidence, the fading of memories, and unavailability of witnesses, which is exactly why the DOJ Moss memo, of course, specifically contemplated that a president could be subject to a grand jury while in office to avoid losing that kind of evidence. Secondly, and equally important here, no one should forget that we've got an investigation that is, you know, looking at the conduct of other people and businesses, and waiting like that would benefit those other participants. They could all end up above the law if the limitations period expires. So delay here is the same as absolute immunity and absolute permanent immunity for the president and others if a statute of limitations expires. That's the problem with the delay.
Well, the other side says the statute would be told against the president, but you're right, it wouldn't be told against other people who may or may not have been committed crimes that he may or may not be a part of, correct?
Correct, and that's important, Your Honor, for the third parties. But I just to address the my friend on the other side's comment about the tolling, I'm not aware in state law of any doctrine of implied tolling that would apply here to protect the state's interests in investigating and potentially prosecuting if necessary down the road. I don't know where that concept comes from, but it's never been articulated by this court. There's no act of Congress which permits that kind of tolling here. And so for us, the statute of limitations is a big concern. We've already lost 9 months of time in this investigation due to this lawsuit. And again, you know, every minute that goes by is, you know, basically without even a decision on the merits here, granting the same kind of temporary absolute immunity that the president is seeking here.
Justice Kagan?
Mr. Dunn, you've been talking about how to analyze these burdens in a case-specific way, the burdens both in terms of the president's time and in terms of any possibility of harassment of the use of a subpoena for political purposes. And Mr. Sekulow said that the burdensome nature of these subpoenas is categorical. That was his term. And I take him to mean that that any subpoena interferes with the president's responsibilities or undermines the president in his handling of the office. So what's the answer to that?
Your Honor, I would make 3 points. I think the fact is that the court addressed this question, I think, in Clinton and concluded that a president can't realistically be shielded from every sort of private distraction, including some forms of legal process, especially in our modern age. So that's why it's up to a court to evaluate and protect a president, depending on the circumstances, on a case-by-case basis. Secondly, here, the claim of, you know, the possible mental distraction is completely speculative, really. It's based on the notion that the president might be, you know, worried and distracted about where an investigation might lead someday. It's not based on any actual Article II burden or interference of the sort the court was asking President Clinton to demonstrate in Clinton v. Jones. And third, I'd say if that's really the concern, I think it's wrong to think that even a categorical rule here would provide comfort to a distractible president like that. So, for example, nobody suggests here that we should be barred from continuing to investigate the president's prior colleagues. So if we now gather documents from them that reflect past communications with him while he was CEO, are we then supposed to be stopped because it could create a fear in him that the investigation of others might lead him to be accused of something someday? Again, my point is that this speculative mental distress standard is not an appropriate basis to draw a constitutional bright line. That's why the case-specific approach is more appropriate.
And speculative mental distress, how about if they really mean political undermining?
Well, I mean, that's beyond the ken of our office, Your Honor. And as, again, the district court found, there was no bad faith intended by virtue of our subpoena. So I don't know. It's already been determined here there's no intent to politically undermine. So I don't know how a court could try to evaluate that. And I'm not sure that would be appropriate.
Mr. Sekulow suggests that you've shown your bad faith by taking the language of the House Oversight Committee's subpoena.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think we've tried to address that. I mean, the simple fact is that in 2018, when our investigation started and thereafter, as we've spelled out, there were a series of public disclosures in the press about possibly illegal transactions involving tax and other financial improprieties. And at the time of the House subpoenas and then our subpoena, it was clear that both our office and the House committees we're looking at the same public allegations in that regard. In a situation like that, once the House subpoena became public, it's not unusual for an office like ours to model our subpoena language on that which has already been made public from a different source when it's going to the same recipient. It makes it easier on the recipient and the process. There was absolutely no communication between our office and the House about this. There's nothing sinister about it, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Justice Gorsuch?
Counsel, I'd like to return to your colloquy with Justices Alito and Sotomayor, because I guess I'm uncertain what the daylight is between the test you're proposing and the test the Solicitor General has suggested. It seems like both of you agree that these questions should be resolved in federal court, and you've suggested that there is the prosecutor should have to be demonstrate an objective basis for the investigation, and that there's at least a reasonable probability that the information sought will be helpful to that investigation, that it can't be obtained elsewhere, and that it's needed now rather than at the end of the president's term because of some serious prejudice that might take place in between. As I understood your discussion with Justice Sotomayor,